Hi, I'm Dan Cooney. I'm an assistant professor of mathematics at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
And my name is Palmia Bahia. I am a neuroscientist, a science communicator, and your host for Biology in Numbers, a podcast by the Society for Mathematical Biology. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dan. How is your day going?
It's going really well. Starting to get some springtime weather in Illinois now.
Oh, yes. I'd imagine that is quite a pleasant break from the winter. So, as the name of the podcast implies, it's all about a field that is a mashup of two others. So you personally, I guess you've already given this away in your position, but do you lean towards team math or team bio?
That's sometimes a tough question, but I guess my degrees were in math and applied math, and I am now in a math department, so I definitely have a feeling towards team math, but I just became affiliated with our Genome Bio Institute, and I've really enjoyed interacting with bio departments and biologists all the way through. So I definitely like both teams. But a secret third answer I have is when I was in grad school, we had intramural teams of flag football and a few other sports, and we called ourselves Team Applied Math. So I like to think of myself as Team Applied Math sometimes.
I like pulling a third one out of the bag. And if anyone were to watch the video clips of this particular recording, you'll see the telltale mathematician blackboard with the chalk equations all over it, which is lovely. So we will dive into your work in a little bit more detail. But for now, can you have a go at describing your research in 60 seconds or less?
So I really like using mathematical techniques to study problems in evolutionary biology, but also ecology and studying human social systems. And I'm particularly interested in situations where there's some sort of tension between what's good for the individual and what's good for the group. These are known as social dilemmas, and studying the population dynamics of social dilemmas and other emergent phenomena from the rules for individuals' interactions to seeing what populations, collections of individuals do.
That's a very succinct answer. So as a member of SMB, can you tell us what it means to you as a researcher in the field?
Yeah, SMB has always kind of felt a little bit like a family. So it feels like when you go to the SMB annual meeting, it's a family reunion. There are certain figures who are known for knowing everybody's name, and they really make a warm environment. And it was something where both the official activities of the community, but also the journal, the Bulletin of Mathematical Biology, was something that really, I think it helped shape my view of mathematical biology. And also, you know, when you're working on your own projects and you've kind of moved into one particular lane, I think it really collects the shared ideas of this field and how, you know, you can go and take a look at some other work in the bulletin or like the talks you see at different conferences, and you can really see new directions for research, different mathematical ideas and different biological ideas, and really get a broader view of the field as a whole.
Yeah, certainly. But I know that you're not just a member, you're part of the SMB team that's responsible for the organization's social media. So first of all, how did that happen? And then secondly, how do you use it and why do you think it's important for the society to do so?
So I think what happened, there's really been a nice tradition even before I started going to the meetings where people have sort of live tweeted or live posted the different talks and conferences. So for example, Maria Abu Chakra definitely like does these whole drawings of the talks that she's listening to and posts them up as a conceptual map. I'm not very good at drawing, but I really enjoyed like going to a talk. And I was always maybe in person a little less comfortable with the live posting, but when we were doing the Zoom conferences, it was easy enough to take a screenshot that I thought was representative and then say, here's what this person's presenting on some topic, and then here's a cool thing I learned about what they're talking about. And so I think it was really just, I posted enough about SMB on social media that the people in SMB, or the people in leadership were like, oh, maybe you want to help do this for us. And, you know, since then, I think the role for me has been sort of highlighting particularly the research that's going on and that's been published in the bulletin, but also trying to make connections with other, there's either new societies and new institutions in mathematical biology in the past few years, one in population biology and the new National Institute for Theory and Math and Biology. And so really trying to connect with these other communities and represent SMB and to the followers of the account, let them know about opportunities, about job positions, workshops, different journal clubs that different subgroups in SMB participate in. And so all these different opportunities there are within MathBio.
Nice. And I think you've kind of answered my next question to some extent, but I think we first started seeing scientists join various social media platforms about 15 years ago, you know, before Twitter went completely off the rails. And I think back then there was a lot of discussion about what the point of it was and whether there was anything meaningful to be gained from spending time posting short messages out into the ether. Now, the scientific community, I think, has largely in the last couple of years shifted from Twitter to Blue Sky. But I think there's potentially less question of its value. And I know since, as you just talked about, you are also active yourself, are there any specific interactions that you've had that have been beneficial to you or your work?
So I started posting on social media when I was a graduate student and, you know, was posting my first projects. And one thing that was really sort of affirming or something that was very encouraging was when, you know, you'd get a reply or like you'd get some engagement from someone who is a leader in the field. What I've learned from posting about your own work or responding to other people's work is that you sometimes meet people that are, they're drawn to your work by a hashtag or by somebody else's reposting your work, or you see someone else's work reposted into your timeline and you learn about things that you wouldn't find if you were only following sort of the traditional channels, like only checking whichever journals you like. Sometimes you wouldn't learn about people from slightly different research communities. And I found it was really nice to follow things that are not quite in my area, but are adjacent. So I'd learn about new ideas. And so I think generally, I think it's been useful just to learn about new research that's out there. But also I think it puts a personal connection that maybe just reading and writing papers doesn't necessarily indicate, or just attending conferences and listening to the talks. So I think it really extended the networking of the community. So you got to meet people and understand what they're interested in. And sometimes people would ask helpful questions and things like this. And so, yeah, it was something that I think really helped the collaborativeness and collegiality of these research communities. So something I really enjoyed for those reasons.
Yeah, I think you touch on this point of collegiality. And I think one of the nice things about social media, it seems like something of an equalizer for researchers from very different career stages, right? So I've seen exchanges between graduate students and professors, which might not happen under other circumstances. So at least I think that it's great from that perspective.
And I think also the global nature of science and that you can interact with people would be very hard to interact with in person, but you really get to share in your common interests. And I guess this was an interesting experience that a couple of my friends, Shadi Sadroy and Olivia Chu and I were supposed to do our first in-person session we organized for a conference, and it was canceled. And we thought, well, why don't we do a Zoom meeting and hold it online for free instead? And so we just posted on social media, and, you know, a lot of people ended up coming, and we didn't even know what to do. We didn't know what co-hosts were back then. Like, we didn't quite know Zoom very well. But, you know, I think people really appreciated the opportunity to hear the talks, you know, coming from all over the country and the world, and also, you know, maybe makes things a little bit less siloed, but maybe you wouldn't travel to an in-person conference for a field that you're not in, like the professional society meeting of a field you're not in, but you would Zoom into a single talk. And so I've liked using social media also along with remote workshops and seminars as an opportunity to try to help build like a more extended academic community.
Yeah, for sure. So going back to your path into the field of math bio, what was it about the subject that first inspired you?
I guess my academic interests were drifting a bit over time, that even going back to high school, taking economics, I really liked the idea of game theory, both from the perspective of, oh, you could use this to model baseball, like the pitcher and the batter, or, you know, equivalent sort of interactions in different sports. And it was like, it seemed there were economic applications. I really liked strategic interaction as a framework for understanding things. And then I took a class when I was an undergrad that was focusing on evolutionary game theory and how game theory can be used to talk about interactions between individuals, and these strategies can be traits or behaviors that either genes can provide, so something that's a model of natural selection, or that can be done sort of used as a behavior that's learned through social learning, or even now people think of AI applications and reinforcement learning agents and things like this. But overall, like, it seemed that game theory was a really nice window into understanding biology. And then when you start reading the textbooks like Hofbauer and Sigmund on evolutionary game theory, they really connect very strongly with ecological questions. And that was another social media find, was the strong representation of the mathematical oncology community and the connections, particularly of evolutionary game theory as a framework for understanding cancer evolution. And so when you see how evolutionary games can be used to study viruses and cancer, and also, you know, the evolution of language and different features of cultural evolution and human social systems, it really seemed like, hey, I should learn a lot more about all this math bio stuff and how people use it in different fields. And so that's sort of how I guess I got interested in mathematical biology.
So can you outline your kind of career path? Where did you study and how did you end up where you are now?
So I was an undergraduate math major at Harvard, and I, like you say, I accidentally got a minor in a secondary field in economics, which the accident is that I really wanted to take game theory and I thought certain economics courses were prerequisites. And then I took game theory courses in the government department that they said actually count for economics. And so I really was a minor in game theory and got some opportunities to work with people and sort of have interactions with Martin Novak's group there. And I particularly worked very closely with Carl Weller, who was an early graduate student when I was a late undergrad, and he really showed me a lot of fun things about research. But then I went to graduate school and applied in computational math at Princeton, and I got to work with Simon Levin, who was very involved in SMB, a former president, and he really showed me a lot of different things about how social dilemmas can be applied to lots of real-world systems. And also, I really enjoyed learning about spatial pattern formation, both from Simon and other folks. And so those are things that kind of got me more into mathematical biology more broadly. And then I did a postdoc at the University of Pennsylvania with Yoichiro Mori and Joshua Plotkin, where they set up a mathematical biology postdoctoral program where you had to have one math mentor and one biology mentor. And that was really something that I learned both more about modeling social systems and sort of game theoretic approaches with Josh, and then learned a lot of techniques about analysis of PDEs, a part of partial differential equations and other differential equation modeling from Yoichiro. And so those were all the steps before coming to Illinois and continuing on with that work. And so I had a lot of great mentorship along the way, a lot of interesting paths about learning about both the math side of things and modeling biological and social systems.
Very cool. Okay, now that we have your background, can you describe your research in a kind of a broad view of what you do?
Yeah, so I think right now I have sort of two research directions that I've been particularly excited about. One of them is in this field of evolutionary game theory, which uses sort of game theoretic ideas to understand the spread of traits and behaviors in a population. I've been really interested in understanding a topic known as multi-level selection. And so the idea is basically that natural selection can often operate at multiple levels of biological organization. So there can be competitions with, for example, with infectious disease spread, the virus strains can compete with each other to replicate within a given individual, but then how they replicate could impact how that virus gets spread to the next individual. And so there are these tensions sometimes between something that's like a cheating behavior that's favored for individuals, but for a group, it would be great if everyone was cooperative. And so I've really enjoyed working on these models that were first introduced by Shishi Lo and Jonathan Mattingly to study differential equations for describing evolutionary competition happening both within and among competing groups. And so within each group, the cheaters might be favored and winning out, but then those groups compete with other groups, and that can help favor the emergence of groups that have very cooperative behavior and things like that. And so that's sort of one direction I've really enjoyed. And the other direction is understanding the role that space and the rules with as individuals move in space may impact the spread of cooperative behavior or the outcomes of individuals have when they are playing games against each other where they are, but they can also move based on features, like maybe they try to move towards places where they think they'll have better payoff, or they can run away from cheaters or run towards cooperators, or there's some environmental quality measurements that they can say they're trying to move towards better environments. And so I guess in a way, the two research themes are basically understanding cooperation across different spatial or organizational skills.
So I realize in retrospect, what I probably should have asked you first is, can you explain what game theory is?
So game theory, I like to describe it as the study of strategic interaction between individuals. So basically, it describes sort of idealizations of scenarios where, for example, if you have two individuals interacting, they can interact in ways where, for example, one can choose to be nice to someone, and sometimes we call that cooperation, or they can choose to be selfish or aggressive towards the other person, which we sometimes, I like to say, we say cheating, but unfortunately cooperate and cheat start with the same letter. So defect is the word that I think shows up in the math because people want to write the C's and D's for cooperators and defectors. So this goes back maybe about 50 years to John Maynard Smith and George Price had these models of, one famous was the hawk-dove game, which I now realize I explain this game to people and people say, oh, which kind of bird are we talking about? And it's hawk and dove more in the aggressive versus peaceful sense. And it describes conflicts over resources where two individuals, two hawks will fight over a resource, two doves will split a resource equally. Or if there's one hawk and one dove, the hawk will be aggressive and take the whole resource and the dove will let them. And so the way that you model how individuals act while competing over that resource is sometimes referred to as a game. And you use that interaction to study what individuals might do if they follow one action, which is maybe be aggressive or be peaceful, when they're facing someone who's following a similar behavior or a different one.
Okay, so I had an opportunity to kind of look through some of your publications. And while I don't understand the majority of them, like some of the themes that come through are really interesting because your research has ranged from, or at least your publications have ranged from things like looking at things on the cellular level with studies into the origins of chromosomes, which I find fascinating, all the way through to how social interactions can lead to the spread of disease. For me, as someone outside of the field, how can you kind of reconcile the techniques and the studies that you do to kind of span all of these kinds of subjects?
So I think that's an interesting feature of using game theory as a model, but sometimes something that's very interesting is that evolutionary game theory, this idea of individuals interacting in some way, and then so game theory is how the interactions occur, and then evolutionary game theory studies how populations change in response to the outcomes of these games. And so one thing that's really interesting is many of the equations that show up in describing how traits or behaviors change are the same or can be derived under lots of different assumptions. And so they can be derived under assumptions that basically say individuals reproduce based on the payoffs or outcomes of these games. And then you look around at the equations for the numbers of individuals and you can study how the fraction of one trait might win out, like all the individuals will end up having one of the two traits. And that's kind of a purely natural selection. You're not imposing any rationality. We're just like, you could have two strains of bacteria growing in a petri dish, and one of them is, you know, paying a cost to help the other break a complex food down to a simple sugar that they can eat. And that's viewed as a game in the sense that there is a cost to help the others. There's benefits from being able to have the food, but there's no thinking. These are genetic kind of, like whether you produce this enzyme to break down the food is a completely genetic feature that there's no rationality involved. But then when people use the same thing to model the evolution of language or different features of human cultural evolution, they can derive similar equations for how the strategies arise by making rules about social imitation. Like maybe one individual, they use an alarm clock, they get picked at random to update their decision, and they look out and they look at a role model and say, hey, that individual seems to be doing better than I'm doing. Maybe I should do what they're doing. And they imitate them. And then it turns out when a whole population of individuals is following this rules, the equations for how individuals are going to change, like individuals will imitate other strategies, turns out to be the same equation as the one that you get from studying birth and death rates that depend on the payoffs from a game. And so even though it's a different idealization, like it's modeling a human social interaction where individuals might be able to choose, make a choice one way or the other, versus sort of a non-thinking kind of very simple organism, just either giving birth or dying. It turns out that there's this really cool universality that some of the same equations, and particularly my favorite equation, the replicator equation, can often be used to describe these things. And so I really enjoy talking about this in talks or in classes where the replicator equation, so that says basically the fraction of a trait or behavior in a population goes up if that trait or behavior is doing better than average in the game theoretic sense. It's getting a better payoff than the average individual. And they go down in frequency when they're doing worse than the average individual. And so several authors have described that as sort of encoding the idea of natural selection or survival of the fittest, that you go up when you're doing better than average, go down when you're doing worse than average. But it also really is something that might make sense also to study in the context of human or other animal social evolution.
Yeah, it's interesting because I guess we don't necessarily think about language that we use, but words like behavior, we apply to humans, but we also apply it to things like cells. So I don't know whether this is kind of a telltale sign that you can apply these techniques across the board.
Yeah, I think an interesting question in terms of what people have been doing is whether the game theory itself sometimes is necessary for evolutionary game theory, in the sense that it might be that it's more natural to look at ecological competition, like the effects of one individual on another. And then sometimes game theory can be used as a way to understand that as well. And so I think there's a lot left to be reconciled, or at least there's a lot left to explore in terms of, you know, how we view evolutionary game theory. How literal is the game aspect or the social interaction modeled as I do this or you do that versus, you know, properties of traits of individuals? And I think one of the really interesting things is that there are probably lots of biological systems that are studied without game theory that could have game theory connected. And also, there are things modeled with game theory that may also be more naturally interpreted or have a nice interpretation that's more drawn from like a typical ecological or immunological modeling toolkit and stuff. So I think it's really nice how it both can be used for lots of things, but also has connections with lots of things people have been thinking about in those fields from sort of looking at those systems individually and things like that.
Absolutely. So we've talked a fair bit about what you're studying. Can you, for your fellow math bio nerds, talk a little bit about the techniques that you use?
Yeah, so I guess I am in an interesting situation where I really like starting with models of individual-based descriptions of populations. So I want to write down the rules, the like sort of stochastic processes, the rules for which individuals give birth or die or they imitate others. And I do this also with groups, or if we're talking about a spatial setting, the rules that groups can succeed or not succeed, or the rules that with which individuals move in space. But I typically like using those to have sort of a sense of where the motivation is coming from these models. But then I like to take limits of large population size and understand either with ordinary differential equations or partial differential equations, sort of descriptions of the collective behavior of the population in terms of, in a way that was derived from the rules for interactions between individuals. And so in the multi-level selection, this results sometimes in a partial differential equation describing the distribution of groups with different fractions of cooperators in them. And this equation describes both the individual level push to have more cheaters winning out within groups, but also a collective competition where groups compete based on their collective payoff or some measure of their collective success. And then in sort of the spatial models, I also like looking at either ODE or PDE limits, and particularly thinking about, you know, things like seeing whether spatial patterns can emerge using typical like linear stability analysis techniques, and also studying the stability and other properties of solutions using things like weakly nonlinear stability analysis, which is a topic I've really enjoyed learning, both going back to my advisor wrote an early paper on that, and also some of the SMB, these techniques with spatial pattern tracing is a place where I feel a lot of connection with SMB, with a lot of the past presidents and other longtime participants, and some of the people with SMB baseball cards. I learned from a lot from their papers on these sorts of techniques. So it's mostly sort of modeling with individual-based dynamics and then deriving differential equations and analyzing those. And I've now enjoyed taking a look back at some of these individual-based models and seeing what I'm trying to learn more to say, what can the differential equations tell us about the original individual-based models as well.
Very cool. And a great way, I think, to kind of close off the conversation by referring back to SMB. I want to thank you so much for your time today, Dan. As someone who spends so much time working on social systems, I think it would be nice for other humans listening to learn a bit more about what you do away from your research. And so I have a few quick fire questions for you to answer. Are you ready? So the first one is, would you rather speak 10 languages or play 10 instruments?
I think I'd rather speak 10 languages. Really be able to communicate and learn things like the humor and perspective from speaking all the different languages.
Absolutely. Do you speak any other than English?
I studied French in school for a few years, and through both an internship in Vienna and interacting with the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology, I've had some opportunity to learn a little bit of German as well.
Ein bisschen.
I'm a kind of
Sugar. Very good. So my second one is, if you can make an office rule that everybody had to follow for a day, what would that be?
I don't know if this counts as an office rule, but I would definitely like, in addition to whatever coffee machines there are, have a constant supply of iced tea for the day. I think whether only I would like it, I think it would be great for the office.
Very good. And finally, this goes back to social media and the memes that we've observed over the years. And this is a particular one, which is, if your life was captured in the kind of expectation versus reality, what would your two pictures be to depict that?
Ooh, I don't know if this is cheating, but I had very good timing when I was in grad school that one of the PhD movies came out when I was in my first year. I think it was the second one. And so the PhD comics, I guess, have been with me the whole way. And I think at least early on as an assistant professor, I definitely feel like the expectations as you're sort of becoming Professor Smith and you're, you know, sitting at your desk and, you know, everything's fine. But I think the furious typing sort of cartoons they have is the reality sometimes still. I recently heard my advisor give a comment saying the best thing that he knew of an economist, it was Kenneth Arrow, was that he never stopped thinking like a grad student, that he always had that curiosity. And so I think the reality is you're the grad student and PhD comic.
I think that'd be really nice to keep hold of that kind of that curiosity and just being inspired by science on a daily basis.
Yeah, the wonder, I think, or sort of the discovery, like finding your first cool result, I think was always something.
What a nice note to end on. Thank you again, Dan. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed all of these podcasts, and it's really fun to talk about mathematical biology.
Been listening to Biology and Numbers, a podcast from the Society for Mathematical Biology and produced by me, Pampit Bahia, at Up the Science Media. A reminder that if you're doing cool stuff within the field of math biology and you'd like a chance to be featured, email Jane Heffernan at president@smb.org. Make sure that you go ahead and pitch your research project, your involvement with SMB, and why you think you should be featured, and we'll look forward to picking some new stars for the pod. As always, you can learn more about SMB on the website smb.org and via social media on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Find the links to all of these and some for today's guest in the episode show notes. Finally, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite platform, and if you like the show, give us some love by reviewing. I think that'd be really nice to keep hold of that kind of that curiosity and the kind of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Just being inspired by science on a daily basis.
Yeah, the wonder, I think, or sort of the
That's the word.
The discovery of like seeing.